welcome to another episode of the Seamless Connection podcast. I am thrilled to have with me a friend of mine, Tom Stanis, who is a co-founder and CEO of Story Health, who's always a joy to talk to. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Mina. I'm glad to be here.
So what I was super excited to have you on for today, beyond all the knowledge you bring about your time in the industry, is getting into how you got into healthcare. So your background is actually as a computer scientist.
Yes.
You worked at Electronic Arts, you worked at Google AdWords before you started Verily Life Sciences with Alphabet before you moved to Story Health. That is a very unusual background for someone that is a CEO and co-founder for a company that is focused on chronic conditions, you know, heart failure, other things like that. What happened?
Yeah, so a couple of different stories here that I think are important to tell. The really impetus of me into healthcare is, this happened about 15 years ago. I was actually working at Google at the time. And I was really into road biking. And so I was biking all over the place. And I was biking in Palo Alto up the peninsula here. And I got hit by a car. I don't remember any of this. I had a concussion. I have no memory. I have this hole in my memory about what happened that day. What I do remember, the first thing I remember after the accident, was waking up in the ED at Stanford and staring at the ceiling and watching the ceiling tiles go by. Imagine what that must be like. They explained to me that I'd been in a car accident, and they said that they need to put me into a CT scan to see whether I had any broken bones. So I went in the CT scan, came out, and they said, well, the good news is you don't have any broken bones. However, there is this mass in your kidney. Do you know anything about that? And it turns out that I had stage 1 kidney cancer and had no idea. And there is no way of knowing when it's stage 1. There's no symptoms. By the time you do have symptoms, it's typically stage 4 when you start to have symptoms of this cancer. And the chance of survival changes dramatically. It's stage 1, 95% chance of survival. It's stage 4, it drops to 5% chance of survival. So you can imagine, if I hadn't been hit by the car, one day I would start to have symptoms, and it would have been a really bleak outlook. But instead, we were able to get ahead of it. And I like to say pretty directly that getting hit by a car saved my life. A little strange thing to say, but very much literally true for me. The other thing that happened at that moment, though, was when you're sitting there waiting for your treatment, you start to reflect on your life and you wonder, am I really doing the most important thing that I can with my time here? Is helping people click on ads and buy apps, is that really the most important thing that I could do for mankind? And I really came to the conclusion, no, what I would really like to do is actually give people the experience I had, where some technology dramatically changes where your health is headed. And so I really kind of got that as a kind of new mission for myself, came back to Google, and that was where I really started to get into healthcare and became, it is still today, this thing that I can rely on as like my why of why I'm doing this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, yes, I think everyone has some kind of, you know, your personal, what's your healthcare story kind of question, but yours is definitely, I think, the most dramatic I've heard at least any time recently. Yeah, so what made you go from that to Story? Because Story is a very, you know, it's not like you're not working in the ED, you're working with patients on a consistent, chronic, kind of ongoing basis. So I'd love to kind of bridge that gap of,
sure,
you know, I get why you're moving now to healthcare, you want to make more of an impactful difference in life. And where the idea from Story come from?
Yeah, so when I came back to Google, we started Verily, trying to work on a lot of these problems. And we worked on a ton of different new technologies and new inventions to really dramatically improve the tools available for managing healthcare. But you see this pretty big gap between ideas and then implementation, validation, and then getting them onto the market and then even getting them adopted in a clinical setting. It's pretty a long road. And what I found most fascinating was that even things that we had been approved and were on the market still had poor adoption out there in real life. So I kind of started to think about this problem of care delivery and how can we really accelerate the ability to have patients be able to access great things. So that's kind of a more intellectual version of it, but the more family-oriented version of it is, my dad had a stroke about 6 years ago, and he received amazing life-saving treatment when he was in the ICU. And I was so thoughtful, so thankful for the neurologists and the neurosurgeons that saved his life. But after he got home, you know, after you've had a stroke, it doesn't end then. Like after you've recovered, it doesn't end. So there's a significant amount of treatment that he needed to be managed on, including many drugs such as Keppra for making sure he didn't have seizures, things like that. And the neurologists and the neurosurgeons were busy saving the next person's life. They actually couldn't find a way to help us manage these medications and get this treatment working continuously. And so I think many of us that have had elderly patients that, you know, elderly family members have gone through this, all experienced this thing where you become this advocate and navigator for your own family members. And wow, if the system is not set up well to support you in this. So that was really, for me, the combination of seeing new technologies not adopted and then seeing specialists struggling to be able to do the work that they wanted to do, to me, was the real impetus behind story. Is how can we change this care model delivery to make these specialists really way more effective and way more scalable in the work that they want to do?
Mm-hmm. And now today, I know you work a lot with cardiology specifically. Can you tell us a little bit more about what Story does on the day-to-day?
Yeah, so Story is really, like I mentioned, all about extending the specialist and making them far more effective. So that starts with, one, can we help you build a treatment plan that goes beyond the clinic? So rather than just having to see people in the clinic visit all the time, which there are very few of, very hard to get an appointment, how can we put together a plan based on guidelines where we're actually going to be changing treatment at home with the patient on a regular basis? And that's a really a kind of a new, cool, novel idea. In order to make that work, though, we also need a couple other things. We need, one, a guidance program for the patient to show them how to change their care as they're going along. So that's another thing that we build. It's both the tool for the physician and also the tool for the patient. And then third, what about all the barriers that we as patients run into at home? Everything from being able to afford our medications to being able to get to the lab. All these other barriers get in the way of getting the right treatment. So we build in a what we call a health coaching team that really assists to make sure that this actually runs really well. So those three components is really what Story builds. And it really makes a huge difference in terms of how much we're able to get people on the right treatment. For example, heart failure you brought up, we've been able to show that, you know, nationally, it's very difficult for cardiologists to keep up with this disease. There's great treatments, but they take a lot of individual changes of treatment. We actually do it all at home now. And we actually, if you look at the science, like 3% of patients get on the optimal treatment based on the guidelines in the nation. We're able to get 60% of people on the right treatment on the guidelines. So dramatic improvement in the adoption of great treatment. And that keeps people out of the hospital. It helps them actually even recover from the disease. So it can make a big difference in terms of the outcomes for our patients.
What's holding people back from, like you said, that 3%, that's a shocking number. What's holding people back from getting on the appropriate guideline recommended treatments versus what are you doing to solve that?
Yeah. So in a lot of cases, you can't just have a clinic visit and put somebody on guideline treatment. Your body needs time to adapt to each of the small changes. It's a long process to adapt to. In fact, it's typically about 12 steps that you have to go through. So if you imagine you have to go through these 12 steps, and by the way, you can probably only get an appointment every month, best case scenario. That's a year to get on the right treatment. By the way, in the meantime, you're probably going to be rehospitalized. And at hospitalization, oftentimes people are reset and have to start all over again. So this is why it's such a problem today, is this combination of the logistics aren't there to support this kind of treatment. So we do it at home, and we do it every week to every 2 weeks do we make these small changes. So you get there much faster, and you can stay out of the hospital and really recover better.
No, that's fantastic. And are you going direct to the patients with this, or is this through health systems and payers that you're working with? Because I'm guessing that while patients can get frustrated, we've seen this a lot ourselves as well on the flip side of the coin, they just don't know where to go for the care. You know they're missing something, but they don't know what it is and how to get it.
Yeah, we started the business initially working with health systems. One of our things that we talk about is Story Health's mission is to transform specialty care together. That together is really important. We know that we think that trust that people build with their doctor is really important to build on rather than replace. So we work with health systems to enable the existing specialists to do more. That's like the beginnings of how we started. However, we've seen from time to time now that there are these things we call specialty deserts, places where there just is no access to any specialists at all. In that case, we've actually had to build a much more opportunity to work with patients directly. And there it's more being referred from the primary care doctor that you might have in those regions, but still building on that trust you have with your doctor rather than something that you don't understand and is strange. I think it's much better to help the existing system solve this problem together rather than trying to build something bolted on the side that confuses patients.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And you and I work in this specialty arena where we see firsthand every single day the shortage of specialists in this country and the impact that's having on care. And I know a lot of the work you do helps specialists that are already in place in the system. Can you just talk to me a little bit about what you've seen with the shortage of specialties? You talked about the specialty deserts, but internally at Story, like in terms of, I know you use both an MD and APP model, right? In terms of other, you know, unique ways to think about getting around the fact that there just aren't enough doctors, even if we wanted them, even if we could hire all of them, there just aren't enough to go around.
Yeah, I think what we need to think about is, and this concept has been around for a long time, the idea of using doctors at the top of their license. Well, it's even more so, I think top of license is really, we're not even getting there because you imagine all the things that doctors doing in a visit. They're charting, they're making decisions, and then they're following through trying to figure out like, why did the patient's prior auth not go through? Or could the patient afford this medication? Tons of things that really are frankly something someone else could happen deal with. So we build a very wide model where we have, you know, maybe one specialist supported by 5 to 10 nurse practitioners that are running the plans that the specialist created. They're the ones on the day-to-day medication changes. And then supporting them are 4 to 5 health coaches per nurse practitioner, helping the patient with all the barriers that they have as well. So you can imagine that we can increase the panel size that a specialist has by 4 to 5x by having this bigger support system out there. That I think is the solution towards being able to meet the demand that we're seeing so often.
No, that makes a lot of sense. As you think about virtual care, because a lot of what you do is virtual, synchronous and asynchronous, how big a role do you see it having today versus how big a role do you think there's potential for it to do more with in the future?
Yeah, I mean, all of us are living our lives in a very asynchronous way more and more with everything we interact with. And it actually makes a lot of sense because it's very difficult to manage our time. So there's a good patient story here that I think is important to tell. We had this one patient. She has heart failure end stage, unfortunately. She's also taking care of her mother, who's elderly, and she's taking care of her sister, who has cerebral palsy, by the way, and she's also working an hourly job. So can you imagine taking care of your own healthcare that's significant when you're dealing with all these family issues and you're working an hourly job? Very difficult. So it's no surprise that this patient no-showed to many, many of their appointments because they can't take half a day off of work to just go to the doctor, right? So by moving to a more asynchronous model that we have where she could text us on her way to work about, hey, I'm having the symptoms from this new medication I started. Can you help me figure out what's going on? Or us texting her asynchronously in the middle of the day and she could look at later saying, this is the next step in your medications. Your meds are ready to pick up from the pharmacy. Dramatic difference, right? So this patient had been labeled by the system as non-compliant because of all these no-shows. So when her disease got worse, she actually started to need a heart transplant. If because of this asynchronous model, she was able to get on the list and actually was able to be evaluated for that heart transplant, that never would have happened if they labeled her as non-compliant. They would never have thought that she was a good candidate. So those are the kinds of stories I think are pretty amazing once you really change the way we're engaging patients into a new model.
I think that's really the key, what you just said there, which is the way we're engaging patients, because a lot of what we do to patients or what historically has been done is very paternalistic. You talk at the patient, right? Or you say, hey, tell us what you want, right? I've seen people go either way. It's either you tell them what to do or you say, I know you've been on Google. Tell me what you want here, right? And it's so refreshing to have an engagement model where the patient has some level of control, an appropriate level of control, but is not the one that has that responsibility to be like, it's all on me, right?
Yes. I mean, it's incredibly overwhelming to have a significant condition being seen by a specialist and not knowing what to do. This is really hard. And you know, you go to the doctor's office and you will probably forget 50 to 75% of everything they told you in the visit. So having someone there to support you as you're going through that plan at home and you start to have those questions like, wait a minute, why do I need to go get these labs done? What is it about? What do these mean numbers mean? That's really important because it's the sort of thing where you can't just deal with 30 minutes every couple months. Like that's just not enough in order to guide you through all of this.
Yeah. No, and what you're talking about is a real impact on outcomes, which mm-hmm. at the end of the day, that's all what we all are looking for, right? We'll talk about different, you know, substitute metrics for that, but that's what we're all shooting for at the end of the day. Can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of outcomes you're seeing? And what really intrigues me there is that next step, right? We've all talked about how this fee-for-service model that we work in today is not sustainable, right? That's part right. of the reason why we don't have the doctors and the type of doctors and the geographic concentration of doctors that we need, because the system doesn't pay them appropriately for the work they do.
Yep.
And what you're doing, the work that we're doing in virtual care, the work that a lot of different people are doing to capture the full scope and scale of what doctors are doing and clinical providers are doing every day, really lends itself to more value-based care or risk-based care models. How do you think about that? And do you think that's actually, because people get excited when they talk about it, but I have yet to hear someone talk about, is that a good thing, right? We all know fee-for-service has its problems.
Right.
You know, but everything has its problems, the devil you know versus the devil you don't. So what are your thoughts on using outcomes to move to value-based or risk-based care? And do you think that actually put us in a better position than where we are with fee-for-service?
Yeah, so there's certain behaviors that we definitely see in fee-for-service that are not necessarily the greatest, right? So, and it's part of it is that it's really hard to attribute your time and your resources to things that make sense, right? So, for example, you email your doctor today with my chart or something like this, and they answer you. In a fee-for-service world, they don't get paid for any of that. There's like no incentive for them to do that. And so it's a real drain on the system, and it's causing a huge amount of burnout. Whereas you can imagine if you're a value-based world, you're incentivized to keep people out of the hospital, completely different, right? So I do think it is a significantly better alignment of incentives. The thing we have to watch out for, though, is we don't really know necessarily the right things to do in order to get to those better outcomes. A lot of times we're kind of like, well, I'll get paid better on better outcomes, and I'll just kind of do what I used to do. Well, no, you actually have to change the way you operate and the way you practice medicine. You actually have to think about these more preventative things like guideline-directed medical therapy, which is, you know, very much aligned with that. Those are new care models that you have to invent in order to make value-based care actually have the outcome that you wanted. I also see this interesting, strange thing happening with this specialist shortage, where we're starting to see a convergence of the fee-for-service and value-based care models in some ways, where, frankly, the hospitals are full. They're full of patients that some of them are high value and some of them are low value. And so while it used to be that, oh yeah, in the fee-for-service world, you get paid if people are in the hospital. Now you've got these low value patients that are in the hospital taking up a bed. That's not good business either. So it's starting to see interesting how that's happening, where we really, the top of license thing is also aligned with fee-for-service. The more that we can get people to spend, to be supported, and so they can spend time on high value work that only a cardiologist could do, that's good for both the fee-for-service and the value-based world alike. So I think that, you know, the right place with the right person at the right time, that's going to make all the difference in terms of if we can do that right, it'll benefit and both, and build almost build a bridge, I think of it, from the fee-for-service world to the value-based world.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And we see that actually a lot now with discussions with hospitals about interhospital transfers, and that you have medication patients taking up, like you said, bed days and bed capacity when they're looking for the more complex patients, or the more procedure driven patient. Exactly.
Right.
Because as we saw with COVID, even if you have full hospitals, if you don't have those procedures, if you don't have those higher value patients, the hospitals are in the red, right?
And
not sustainable.
We've seen this from a lot of consulting groups that are saying that the average heart failure hospitalization is a net negative contribution margin of $1,000 for every patient in the bed, right?
For bed day, or just overall for their stay?
For the whole stay. And that's across all systems. You know, for some of the more academic systems, it's much worse than that. They're losing even more money.
Yeah. That's amazing. Well, where do you see both yourself and Story Health going next? I know there's a lot of areas that you want to work in personally. I know there's a lot of areas that Story itself is moving into as a company. Can you share a little bit about what's coming next?
Yeah, so for us, I think we've always built this medically informed position where we really want to deeply understand the conditions that we manage. But there's also an opportunity for more of a horizontal opportunity here, where we can help patients that have many different kinds of diseases that need support outside the hospital. So we're starting to build that kind of more general purpose framework to work across specialties. I think this is really exciting, because most patients don't have one specialist they're seeing. They see a cardiologist and a nephrologist and an endocrinologist, very common. And yet a lot of times we're seeing treatments start to overlap. Some of the drugs are the same, things like that. So starting to build a treatment plan that connects these specialties together and allows for a more holistic plan for a complex cardiometabolic patient, that's the exciting future that we're headed towards.
That's fantastic. And how about you personally? I know you've got a lot of runway here with Story left, but what, you know, if you're looking at 5-10 years out, where do you want to be? And is it still in healthcare, or are you moving on to the next big thing?
Well, no, for me, this is very personal, right? So I think that it's very empowering when you see each patient's story. That's what keeps me going. So, but I do think that in order for every patient to experience that, it's going to take a significant change in the system. And that does not happen overnight. That's a decades long project in order to transform healthcare. And you have to have patience for that. So many projects in healthcare that I think are especially started out of the tech world are ended too soon. They basically said, oh, this doesn't work after 3 or 4 years. And I'm like, no, you need the persistence to see it through. So that's, for me, that's what this is all about.
No, that's fantastic. Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today and give us a little bit of the insight into what made you start Story and the impacts that you guys are seeing on a day-to-day basis. It's such exciting work. It's such important work you guys are doing. I'm looking forward to seeing you take the whole kit and caboodle along with cardiometabolic.
Thank you, Mina. Appreciate it.